Tonight on Arena, among the movies up for review is the latest Netflix offering, Tiger Tail, and we look at Sunday night's One World Together at Home concert. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, lots of things have changed in our day-to-day lives in recent weeks, but one thing you can be sure of is that Thursday night is still movie night here in Arena, and we have a mix of old and new for you this evening. Alan Yang's Tiger Tail is a recent Netflix production and is a poignant tribute to Yang's Taiwanese ancestry. And we turn our critical eye to two older movies that seem to capture the current zeitgeist, Contagion and Outbreak. Joining me now are Gemma Cray and Paul Whittington. And we'll start with the newest of the three, the Netflix offering Tiger Tail, certainly not to be confused with the same platform's documentary series, Tiger King. And Gemma, this new film, Tiger Tail, it's a real departure for director Alan Yang.
Yeah, so we would be more familiar with his work on shows like Master of None, which is a dramedy comedy also on Netflix, as well as Parks and Rec, which is very beloved and full of humour. And this is something completely different. It's a real deep dive, a quiet, emotional story. So we first meet Pin Sui, and he's a lonely, closed-off, middle-aged man who's unable to connect with his family. Meanwhile, we kind of flash back and forward to his life when he grew up. So we originally meet him when he's this free, young child growing up in Hawaii, in Taiwan. It's really, the film tracks his arc and how he goes from being that free, fun-loving spirit, a teenager with dreams, to being this quiet, resentful, lonely man.
How difficult was his life, Paul Whittington, his life growing up in Hawaii?
That's one of the very interesting things about this film, Sean, because the Asian experience in America has been unexplored until quite recently. His life was hard. He lost his father and then lived with his grandmother for a while in rural Taiwan in the middle of it. He was very close to his grandmother, also later to his mother. But he grew up, he was sort of lonely growing up, an only child, and then as he gets older, he falls then in love, which leads to a kind of fateful decision he makes.
Yeah, the vital part of this story really is it's a longed after early relationship that seems to haunt him right through his later life, Gemma.
Yes, so he Awan is a wealthier, from a wealthier background, and they have this instant spark. They connect on a creative and fun-loving level, which he never recreates in his life after that. Now, they bond, they're so close, but fundamentally he chooses the responsibility to look after his mother over their relationship, and he ends up marrying Zen Zen instead and moving to the States because it's the best way for him to provide security for his mom. And I think that's when he really goes into himself. And while Zen Zen is able to kind of go out into America and to make friends in the community, he is working jobs and becoming more and more isolated. And even as a couple, they're not particularly close.
That time in Hawaii, in Taiwan, in rural Taiwan, there's much made early on in the film about the use of Mandarin as a language and the use of Taiwanese as a language, Paul. Was there political strife at the time in Taiwan, and does that play much into his story?
Yeah, there was, and Mandarin was the language of the go-aheads, if you know what I mean. And obviously, Taiwan was then entering into a kind of political opposition to communist China, and so there was a kind of social upheaval, and there was a great strain. And both Pin Sui and Yuan, his first love, Dream of America for romantic reasons, but also I think in order to get away from the confusion in Taiwan. Zima, who plays him as an older, sadder man, he was people will remember him from The Farewell, that great comedy from last year, and I think he's a real strength in this film. He's so melancholy and he's so closed off within himself, and his relationship with his grown-up daughter is fraught because she's similar to him. She's an introvert, she's stubborn, and the idea of some kind of redemption will possibly come through her.
In fact, let's take a clip that gives us a sense of that relationship. In this scene, following the Chinese New Year party, the father, Grover, played by Tsima, as you said there, and his adult daughter, Angela, played by Christine Koh, try to communicate.
Mom seems happy.
I'm glad for her.
This is the first time I've hosted this party by myself. Without Eric. Sometimes I wonder if I'll ever find anyone like him again. When we're together, it just felt different. Do you know what I mean?
There was a woman once. I knew her before your mother. In Taiwan.
I didn't know that.
There are many things I never told you.
That's Tsima as the father there, Christine Koh as the daughter, Angela, in the Netflix film Tiger Tail. Paul Whittington and Gemma Cray are our two reviewers this evening. Gemma, that's about as animated as they get. That's probably close to a full-scale row between the two of them. It's a very muted tone in this film.
It's all about what's unsaid. If you look at these kind of two main characters, they're the people that are struggling because they're not able to communicate. And in so many ways, this is a film about isolation and people not being able to communicate, and basically the deep toll it has taken on both of these people. What I think is there's an optimistic tone in Angela. Is there's so much cyclical sort of negativity that's passed down from Pin Sui's grandmother to him, and then he's passing it along to his daughter Angela. And I think it's really about them finding a way to kind of restructure it and break that cycle of repression, essentially, which I think speaks very well to
isolation
Irish
as Gemma
cultural.
Yes, indeed. And isolation, as Gemma points out there, Paul, is one of the big themes. It's not the only big theme on offer here. Intergenerational trauma is vitally important too.
Absolutely, yeah. And in a way, the impossibility of one generation communicating to the next actual hardship, like economic hardship. It's so often the case that people who've been poor and who then rise up into the middle class just don't discuss it with their children, which leads to all sorts of other problems, as Gemma's suggesting. There's a lovely scene in this film. I think it's the best scene, where she, as a little girl, his daughter is, or she's 10 or 12, or she's doing a piano recital, and she just has a blank in the middle of it. And she's devastated, obviously, and it's before a big audience. Instead of comforting her afterwards, he says what his grandmother said to him, you know, stop crying, don't be weak. And it's exactly the wrong thing to say.
What about the two different worlds that we get here? There's the world of Taiwan and those flashbacks, and then the present day moment, which is in America. Are they equally balanced? Do both sides work as well for you, first of all, Gemma?
Yeah, definitely. You get tonally the environment that Pin Sui is in really changes as to his mental state. So when he's younger in Hawaii, he's a lot freer. He's running through the fields. They're very brightly lit. He's enjoying the space. When he's with Awan, he's relaxed. They're listening to music. It's all there in the production design. It's warm. Then when he's a bit older and he goes to America, that's when the kind of the weight of the world is upon him, and the responsibilities of the world are upon him. And this is all kind of reflected. It's almost a loud alien landscape, and it's full of fear and stress and loneliness of him working in almost like the confined spaces of the shop, where he's kind of stuck grafting day in, day out. And you can see that kind of resentment build in him, and it's all there in his physical surroundings.
I think the Taiwanese part of the movie worked better for you, Paul.
Well, in a way it did, but as Gemma suggests there, the Taiwanese part is lush because it's remembered. So it's his memories of it as much as how it necessarily was. A few critics of this film have pointed to the fact that the scenes in the present day and in America are kind of flat, but maybe that's sort of deliberate. Maybe that's the counterpoint to his sort of remembered life. So I think overall, there's something very poignant about it. Its tone is sort of somber, as you suggest. But I think overall it works well. And as I said, Tsima is excellent in it. And it's also very... Joan Chen turns up playing Juan as an older person, looking remarkably well-preserved. And that's a very poignant scene as well.
All right. Stars from you, Paul?
3.5 from me, Sean.
And from you, Gemma?
3.5 as well.
All right, let's move on then to two older films which have been spoken of quite a lot in recent weeks, in fact, because perhaps of their relevance to our current pandemic situation. Wolfgang Petersen's Outbreak from 1995, starring Dustin Hoffman, René Russo and Kevin Spacey, and 2011's Contagion, which starred Kate Winslet, Marion Cotillard and Jude Law, and was directed by Steven Soderbergh. We'll go to the older of the two. First of all, Gemma, Outbreak, 1995 film, as I said, stellar cast, in fact, both movies are stellar casts, I think you could argue. But what about the plot of Outbreak? We start out in Zaire in the 1960s.
Yeah, so it starts as it means to go on. Lots of cheesy, very surfacey characters, glib, like kind of one-liners, and lots of action. And you can just tell this is a film that's of its time. It's big budget. It's Hollywood. And it's enjoyable. There's nothing too self-referential about this film whatsoever. So it starts off in 1967. There's a mysterious Ebola-esque outbreak that's ravaging a military hospital there. And we cut to two kind of mysterious military health workers, fully gowned up, very sinister looking, as they go in and take samples. Now, as soon as they leave that camp, promising all sorts of help and assistance, they actually vomit. And the only things to escape are these two screeching monkeys that we'll obviously get back to later. Mm. Now, the proper story kicks in 1995, which is sort of modern day, as modern day as this film gets. And we meet Dustin Hoffman's character, Colonel Sam Daniels, as he's having a bit of a domestic issue with his ex, Roberta Kyo, about the management of their dogs. Now, when he's there, he is a scientist working for the US Army and doing medical research, and he gets a call about another outbreak in Zaire at the same time. So himself and his team go to investigate it. So he has, again, phenomenal cast, Kevin Spacey, who's playing a kind of sassy Colonel Schuller, and then Cuba Gooding Jr., who's a lot more reserved and intense as the Major Salt, and they're going out to investigate this outbreak. Now, as soon as he gets out there, they all realise this is something that's very serious, and they try to flag this in their ranks then as being something that might pose a problem to America. But of course, they suffer the usual scientist in the beginning of a disaster movie problem, where they're just told it'll be fine, don't worry about it, until it's not fine.
All right, well, let's listen to a scene, in fact, where the contagious disease expert Sam Daniels, played by Dustin Hoffman, confronts his army boss, General Billy Ford, played by Morgan Freeman, with some frightening news about the virus.
Excuse me, General, you got a minute?
Oh, there you are, Sam. Colonel Briggs has been looking for you. Colonel, take this man into custody.
We're in deep shit, Billy. The virus is aerosolized.
What are you talking about?
It's going airborne.
Colonel, would you excuse us?
Certainly, sir.
Mataba is only spread through direct human contact. Now, you said that yourself, Sam.
I know what I told you, but now I'm telling you we're facing a new strain.
What?
It spreads like the flu.
Impossible.
Fine. Go to the hospital, check it out yourself. Go without a mask, you'll see more clearly. You got 19 dead, you got hundreds more infected, and it's spreading like a brush fire. You got to isolate the sick, and I mean really isolate them, Billy. We got to get everybody else back into their houses. We got to keep them there.
We're doing that, Sam.
No, we're not doing it, because I just drove through 100 people. And if one of them has got it, then 10 of them have got it. And if one of them gets out of Cedar Creek, Billy, then we're in deep fucking shit. And we're already in deep fucking shit. And if you're going to arrest me now.
All right, Sam, all right.
Don't threaten me. Don't threaten my crew. Please, leave us to do our work.
All right, Sam, all right. You were never here.
No, I was here. I followed the bug here. I've always been here. And you remember that.
Dustin Hoffman and Morgan Freeman there in a scene from Outbreak. Paul Whittington, when we listened to that, I wonder if that door stayed on its hinges as he slammed it when he left the, went off the set there. But as we listened to that, you know, I kind of worry about films like this. Do they say much to us about our current situation, or in fact, could they just panic us even further if we're feeling panic stricken at the moment?
Well, I think this is such a silly film, Sean, that I don't think it would panic anybody. At one point, Dustin Hoffman rises to his full height and utters the immortal words, "Many people are dying and are going to continue to die unless we find this monkey." So it's a very silly film. It's a very typical 90s sort of schlock disaster movie like Independence Day. You can hear all the overacting. They're all shouting at each other. So this one I did not find unsettling whatsoever. However, Contagion, which is not a good film, I would say, is unsettling because it's very close to the mark.
All right, well, we'll go a little bit further into that. Why is it so close to the mark and Outbreak so far away from the mark in your mind?
Well, Outbreak, certainly, to begin with, Outbreak is kind of about an Ebola-like epidemic, but the science is deeply silly in the sense that you see this map of America and, like, day one, there's 10 cases, day two, there's 2,000, day three, like, it takes 3 days to wipe out everybody. Contagion is more about something similar to what we are going through. There's even a bat in it. The bat is the baddie. And as I say, it's not a very good film. I remember, if I may take the liberty of quoting myself, Sean, my own review from the time, I said in 2011, I said, "Pandemic should be scary, but this one's merely dreary and much funnier than a plague has any right to be. But it's not funny watching it now, because for all its shortcomings, it really gets so much right in terms of, you know, social distancing, societal problems. It's eerie how good the science was on it, really."
Yeah, I want to listen to a clip that gives us a sense of that. Kate Winslet plays the character of Dr. Erin Mears, and she and her team are trying to trace who might be a carrier of the virus.
"Is there anyone else who might have had contact with her?"
"This was everyone.
Aaron Barnes did."
"Barnes, he worked on another floor.
There were documents she needed to sign. He picked her up from the airport."
"He picked her up from the airport?"
"Yes."
"Where is he?"
"Hello?
Hello? Mr. Barnes?"
"Yes.
This is Dr. Mears from the Centers for Disease Control. I believe you may have had contact with Beth Emhoff last week."
"Yeah, I picked her up at the airport. What's this about?"
"How are you feeling today?"
"Pretty cruddy, to be honest. Head is pounding. I probably picked up some sort of bug."
"Where are you right now?"
"I'm on the bus, heading to work."
"I'd like you to get off immediately."
"Wait, what? What's going on?"
Where's the bus, Aaron?
Lake and Lindale. Can you tell me what's
Lake
going
and
on?
Lindale. I really need you to get off that bus. Listen, it's quite possible you've come in contact with an infectious disease and that you're highly contagious. What? Do you understand? I want you to get off now and stay away from other people."
No, what do I do?"
"Don't talk to anyone. Don't touch anyone. That's the most important thing. We'll send somebody to meet the bus."
"Okay.
I'm on my way to you now, Aaron."
And there we have Kate Winslet and a group of others there in the scene from Contagion. And as Gemma Cray and Paul Whittington have been suggesting to us, it's perhaps much more frightening than the older film Outbreak. In fact, the research for this, Gemma, you were saying, quite a lot of very scientific research was done, and that's what gives it its great reality and truth.
Yeah, so Scott C. Burns is the screenwriter. He worked with Steven Soderbergh on The Informant, which also starred Matt Damon. And he did 2 to 3 years research on this film, where he hung out in places like WHO and the CDC and met all the scientists that are represented in the film and got a sense of the bureaucracy and how everything worked firsthand. And one of the things I thought was very interesting that he said in an interview recently, he said he was really, really afraid when he found out Trump cut funding to the CDC, because he said when he was doing his research for this film, every single scientist he spoke to said it's not a matter of if this happens, it's a matter of when this happens, which is unnerving. But again, What I think he does very, very interesting as a screenwriting perspective is just throw out the rule book completely in so many ways. He doesn't kind of adhere to three act structures. It's instead of an ensemble cast, which is a very kind of one way of describing it, it's nearly like a mosaic of cast of characters, and he does kind of weaves the story in between them very, very well, and creates such a dense world in such a short period of time.
What about watching either Contagion then or Outbreak at this particular moment in time? How do you feel about either or both of those films? Would you recommend one or the other, or would you just stay clear? Gemma, first of all.
So if you are in the mood of just having a bit of a laugh at the whole scenario and want to have a Zoom party with your friends and a bottle of wine and some popcorn, watch Outbreak, because it's ridiculous. It's so over the top. Like, I mean, even such kind of well kind of established actors, you can see them have trouble getting out some of the lines because they're so silly. While if you want to have the fear of God put in you, because what I watched Contagion for the first time in February when this was starting to kick off, and I thought, oh, that's hilarious. So much of it is true. That's very amusing. And then actually I watched it again just very, very recently. And the whole thing took on a whole other shape the second time that I watched it, because so much of what had happened in that film actually played out. So what I would say is, if you're kind of in the mood of something horrible and very, very gritty, and maybe, like, I mean, at the end of the day, there is an end to Contagion. Like, it doesn't end with the whole world being wiped out or anything like that, not to give a spoiler alert, but that is how most of these things do happen.
Yeah.
It's interesting to watch, but I would definitely say be prepared, because it's not easy.
And what would you say, Paul, regarding the two movies?
Well, I would say, as Gemma said, Outbreak is a laugh. Like, it's just, you know, have a laugh, have a drink, watch it, you know, have a laugh. Contagion, I think it could go either way. The first time I heard about this craze for watching it was about a month ago, when my sister's teenage girls, I'd heard they were watching it, and they were quoting some of the lines because there are some cheesy lines. And I think for some people it could work as a kind of, you know, a way of sort of quietly confronting through drama what's going on and saying, okay, I can deal with this. This isn't as bad as that or whatever. But certainly if you're of a nervous disposition, Sean, I would not recommend it.
All right. Well, that's pretty clear advice from Paul Whittington and Gemma Cray. Outbreak and Contagion, the two zeitgeist movies, if you like, that they were speaking about, and Tiger Tail, the Netflix offering that we spoke of earlier on. Now, just as we came to air this evening, we heard the sad news of Brian Dennehy's death. The actor, star of stage and screen, was 81, and he died, his family say, of natural causes in Connecticut. He made more than 150 films, including Tommy Boy, First Blood and Cocoon. He was equally at home on Broadway, where he won Tony Awards for two iconic roles, Willie Loman in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, that was in 1999, and James Tyrone in Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey in Tonight in 2003. Irish audiences got a chance to see Brian Dennehy on stage in Ireland twice, in fact, in The Iceman Cometh at the Abbey Theatre in 1992, and more recently in 2010 and 11, he played the Bull McCabe in John B. Keane's The Field, directed by Joe Dowling and produced by Pat Moylan. And Pat joins me on the phone right now. Sad news indeed, Pat. How did you first approach Brian Dennehy about the idea of playing the Bull?
Yeah, very sad. Very sad to hear that today. I mean, he was just such a great character. It's just, I was heartbroken when I heard the news. I produced this play with Breida Cash and Donald Shields back in 2011. And it, you know, when you kind of don't decide to produce The Field unless you have a Bull. It goes hand in hand. You don't say, I'm going to do The Field and I'm going to get a Bull. You have to do them simultaneously. So we had bandied around a number of names, and then somebody came up with the idea of Brian Dennehy, but how would we get him? So I got a number for his manager, and called the manager, and she said that leave it with me and I'll be back to you. And I remember, you know, just coming back late in the evening, having been out at a meeting, and somebody said, Brian Dennehy's manager called back and he wants to do it. Absolutely. Is delighted. Would kill to come to Dublin to do that part. So it was that easy. Sometimes it's really hard to get an actor to do a part, but this was the easiest thing ever. Sorry.
Go ahead, Pat.
And no, it was kind of a dream from beginning to end in that regard, because, you know, then you think, oh, you're negotiating with a Hollywood star. Is this going to, you know, be really difficult? Not at all. Everything was really easy. You know, where you know, when they come over, where would you like to stay? Just get me somewhere central that, you know, where I can make a cup of tea for myself. That's all he was looking for, you know, just. There were no riders or anything like that.
I saw an interview that he gave with the Late Late Show around that time with Ryan Tubridy, I believe, and he spoke about his grandfather, who was Irish and who had emigrated from Ireland, and he said that the grandfather was, in fact, very like the Bull McCabe. Did he speak to you about anything like that?
Yeah, he did mention it. I mean, he had a great love for Kerry and for John B. Keane's work. And the family, Brian and his family had a house at one stage somewhere on the Kerry, I think it was on the Kerry-Tipperary border. And they went there regularly. So he just loved Ireland and loved, you know, people from Kerry. So, I mean, this was just a dream come true for him, is what he told me on many occasions, being offered this part.
What do you think he brought to that role of the Bull McCabe?
Well, Sean, in many ways, I would say he, first of all, his physical presence was very commanding. I mean, it was, you know, he was frighteningly big looking, huge shoulders. And I also think with, you know, like any good actor, what he brought to the part was what he didn't say. I mean, you know, John B. Keane's wonderful language is there, and it's very threatening from the Bull. But I think he was equally threatening when he was just standing there in silence and his looks and stares. And I think when you sit in an audience and you're frightened at somebody who isn't saying anything, they've won you over.
And the other thing about that physical presence, I mean, I remember the Iceman Cometh, as you say, that ability to absolutely stand still. But I wondered, as the run of the field progressed, how much did his interpretation of the role change? Did you see it grow in any way?
Well, you know, obviously it grows. I mean, actors, particularly in a big part like that, they kind of do grow into it. And I mean, maybe his best performance wasn't the opening night, it was all very subtle. And the other thing was, he was absolutely in awe of the cast he was working with. He spoke highly of them on so many occasions. He said to me many times, "I cannot believe the talent in this company." I mean, he was in great company, I know, and they were all talented. But he was absolutely in awe of their talent. He said he hadn't come across that before. From all of the parts, from the larger parts right down to the very small parts, they were all so great.
Yeah, indeed. Like, among the cast members there were Dermot Macarty, Aidan McArdle, and very many others too of the Irish theatre scene.
Yeah, Brendan Conroy and Gareth Lumberg. You know, it was a wonderful cast. Oh.
Well, as I said, Pat, thanks for joining us this evening with That Sad News. And I asked Pat about that idea around how a character might grow over the run of the play, because I have a clip featuring Brian Dennehy himself, and he's speaking here about his love of theatre.
I've been pretty lucky. everybody always say, "My God, you won 2 Tonys." I said, "Yeah, I won 2 Tonys for Tony playing Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman and James Tyrone in Long Day's Journey into Night." You better be right up there in the numbers, because those are 2 of the greatest parts ever written in this country. Now, those parts are fun to do for a long period of time, because you never find the end of them. I mean, I did Willie 650 times, and the last week I was doing it in London, although you are kind of looking forward to not doing it, every night you would see another door that you hadn't opened. There'd be something, some other place to go. And I remember coming back to the States and driving in someplace in Connecticut, and all of a sudden something occurred to me. I pulled off the road and I sat there for 10 minutes thinking about one of the scenes that I was never going to play again in a whole different way. It's a great part will give you those opportunities, and you have to approach it that way. You have to allow everything that happens to you in the day. Once you learn the words and music, and you learn it pretty solidly at that point, everything that happens to you in the daytime becomes part of your performance, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's good.
Brian Dennehy there, the great actor whose death was announced today. He was 81. This evening, we're starting a new series, which we're calling Where Do I Begin With? The intention is to select artists over a variety of genres who have, for one reason or another, genuinely qualified for the overused description of iconic. And for people not familiar with these artists, we'll be identifying where might be a good starting point to access their work. We get the series started with a man whose career has, for many, been defined by just one song.
Oh, we should take.
Ah, here, get a room, the pair of you, would you? That's Serge Gainsbourg there and Jane Birkin with Je T'aime. And to discuss the career of Serge Gainsbourg and specifically where would be a good starting point to access his body of work, I'm joined by Jennifer Gannon. And I'm pretty sure the first thing you will say to me, Jennifer, is that is not a good starting point for the work of Serge Gainsbourg. But for many people, that's what they'll think of. Is it an albatross around his neck?
I mean, I think with Serge, a lot of people dismiss him as, you know, the dirty old Frenchman responsible for Je T'aime. And I think that's a side of him that he did play up to, and he enjoyed doing so. He liked to push those boundaries. If there was boundaries, Serge was pushing them. And I think a lot of his more provocative work would even be deemed too much by today's standards. But there's a lot there in his whole repertoire. Like, he was a very mercurial, experimental artist. He moved throughout his career from jazz to pop to rock to reggae to electronica. And there's no real genre that defines him, I think. And that's probably why he feels quite overwhelming to people or intimidating, that you wouldn't know where to start with him or his career.
Mm-hmm. Well, where did Just Him come in that career, by the way? And is it a little bit before Where You Would Get Us to Start or after Where You Would Get Us to Start?
It's actually after Where I Would Get Us to Start. He kind of took a detour. Like, at the beginning of his career, it was very much wrapped up in, which was the late 50s, early 60s, in the chanson kind of style, which was almost like cabaret, light jazz. And then Je T'aime didn't come along until the latter half of the 60s. But where I think we should begin for anybody that's interested in his back catalogue would be the 1964 album that he did, which was his sixth album, which is Gainsbourg Percussion or Gainsbourg Percussion. And I think it's an album that signals his move into a greater creative freedom. Setting aside, he was like a writer for hire, and he was used to write many pop songs. He wrote the Eurovision entry for Franz Gall that won for Luxembourg in 1965. So this is the album that kind of actually moved him into a more artistic realm, where it, as the title suggests, it was exploring his love of rhythm and beats. It's inspired by Latin American and African music styles of artists like Miriam Makeba or Babatunde Olatunji, and the influential Missa Luba album from 1958 that was featured in Lindsay Anderson's film If. And I think it's all built around the African Burundi drumming, which had a real resurgence in the 60s at the time, which is this kind of continuous percussive sound. And it's kind of, this album is what I would expect it'd be like Serge's Graceland, like several decades before Paul Simon.
Right. Well, the album, as you say, is called Percussion. Let's have a listen to the sort of sounds he was making. This is a song called Couleur Café.
J'aime ta couleur café, tes cheveux café.
Couleur Café, and that's from Serge Gainsbourg's sixth album, Percussion. And speaking to us this evening is Jen Gannon about where to start with Serge Gainsbourg, and that is the album that you choose. You really get a sense of it even within that song. His impishness, there's a sense of humour in there, there's a little bit of fun going on. That's a vitally important thing to keep in mind when thinking of Gainsbourg, I think you would say, Jen?
I definitely would. I think that's what I love about him, and I love the fact that, you know, it sets him apart from other troubadours. So he's got some kinds of, you know, lumped in with people like Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen, but I think he's less po-faced than that. And also the fact that he loved the construction of a pop song. He loved those songs that, you know, didn't outstay their welcome. He wrote loads of them for people, you know, like Franz Gall, like even Francois Hardy and the actress Anna Karina. He wrote so many pop songs, and he loved that kind of the immediacy of them and the throwaway nature of them. And I think that's something that sets him apart from a lot of his contemporaries. And I think he enjoyed that. He enjoyed always the wordplay and that kind of the double entendre. And I think even in a song like Cooler Café, he's talking about, you know, admiring a woman's coffee-coloured skin. And I think that were sentiments at that time in France that he didn't really appreciate or embrace at the time. So it was a bold move, and it was adventurous. Mm-hmm. And it shows him kind of shifting into this artistic gear, and he's ready to experiment and try new things.
Yes, but I did see a video for that song online today, and it seemed to bring up the old idea of Serge, the dirty old man's image that you mentioned earlier on, because it's of a very scantily clad young woman dancing all around him, of course, as he sings and ogles at her. Can he do that? Is there any way that he could have done that would get rid of that voyeuristic aspect that seems to be so marked in his work?
I mean, I think that the thing is, he enjoyed doing that. He enjoyed encouraging this conversation around a controversial character. He played up to it, and that was his style. He wanted to always, you know, challenge the establishment, and he thought that this was the way to do things, and creating this almost character, this caricature, almost a grotesque one of this, you know, old man, dirty old man, which I think is all embedded in his music.
What was his relationship with Brigitte Bardot?
Well, they were once lovers, and he wrote a lot of songs for her on her album, and there is a compilation album, which would be, there is the iconic doomed romance song Bonnie and Clyde, and that's on the other album that I would recommend, Initials DB from 1968, and that's the post Je T'aime time. And I think the two of them, he enjoyed the fact that she was basically a God-created, you know, woman. She was this figure of sexuality in France at the time, and he was always dismissed as this kind of troll under a bridge. So he loved the dynamic that they had together of this almost Jekyll and Hyde, or, you know, this Beauty and the Beast kind of cartoonish nature of their relationship. But she really did. He was very inspired by the women in his life and his muses, and he wrote a full album before Initials BB. He wrote a full album with Jane Birkin, who he'd just started a romance with. And he loved to write these songs around these women about their romantic escapades.
Well, Initials BB, the title of the album. Let's have a little listen to a part of the song called Bonnie and Clyde.
Lorsque j'ai connu Clyde autrefois, c'était un gars loyal, honnête.
Brigitte Bardot there, Bonnie and Clyde, the song from Serge Gainsbourg's album Initials BB. Jen Gannon helping us to get started with Serge Gainsbourg if we so wish, and get beyond Je T'aime. You've given us two albums up to this point, Jen, but really you're going to finish up with what you refer to as the masterwork. What is that masterwork?
Yeah, The History of Melody Nelson, which was released in 1971. And I think it's a fine album that sounded unlike anything at the time and still sounds completely unique even in 2020. Like artists like Beck, Broadcast, Air, David Holmes, Pulp, Portishead, Super Free Animals, the list goes on. They're really indebted to this 1971 work. Melody Nelson, it's a collaboration with the composer and arranger Jean-Claude Venier, and they'd assembled a bunch of top session musicians for the job. But Serge and Venier, they just had little interest in the kind of 70s conventional rock sound. So they created The History of Melody Nelson, which is a concept album, but unlike the concept albums at that time, which were achingly boring, I think, this one is a snappy 20 minutes long. It's still Serge's obsession with the pop sound. and it's really lavishly orchestrated, but the dominant instrument isn't the guitar. It's actually Herbie Flowers' seedy, rambling bass that sounds really alluring and treacherous. And we know Herbie Flowers because he's responsible for the slinky Walk in the Wild side bass line. So this album is like a fantasy and a fiction. It's, you know, under the name Melody, which is, you know, his muse and lover, Jane Birkin, who is the inspiration, and she's on the front cover of the album. But it's really all about the narrator and the brooding nature, desire and obsession. And it's, you know, the scope and ambition in these 28 minutes is extraordinary. You move from funk, pop, rock, and even, you know, a dash of Isaac Hayes' soul kind of sound. It's a musical version of Lolita Fantasy, but it has this creeping sense of melancholy and dread and darkness. Basically, what I would describe it as is a midlife crisis wrapped up in an orchestral bow. And I just think it's some of his best work that he probably could never live up to or match to any kind of degree subsequently, unfortunately.
And Jane Birkin, the muse here, and she, I suppose, thinly disguised in the character of Melody Nelson, does she perform on the album as well?
She does, yeah. She is featured on a couple of tracks on it. And, you know, at all, it reaches this alarming crescendo, the story itself, on this astonishing finale, Cargo Culte, where Melody, this, you know, this fleeting obsession, she perishes in a plane crash. And it's got this massive choir and it's dazed and strained and has a whispered spoken word. It's unlike anything you would hear. And the thing about Serge is he feels so contemporary that artists like from the Happy Mondays to MC Solar to Kylie Minogue, they've all sampled him. And he reminds me, he's like, you know, another visionary artist, George Clinton. His tracks are always given a new lease of life and heard by new ears because of this continuous sampling, because he loved to noodle around in the studio and create repetition and loops. And, you know, that's what he was doing on Gansberg Percussions. He was paying tribute to artists that he loved, and he inspired other artists to do that. And I think there's nothing greater a testament to the man and his music, the fact that it still goes on. It's still in the veins of pop music today.
All right, well, let's finish up by listening to a track from Histoire de Melody Nelson, the 1971 album of Serge Gainsbourg. This is the song Ballade de Melody Nelson.
Pauvre Melody Nelson.
Mais elle en avait des tonnes. Mais ses jours étaient comptés. 14 automnes et 15 étés.
One World Together at Home is an online concert which will be broadcast this weekend and features the biggest names in pop and rock music such as Paul McCartney, Taylor Swift, Stevie Wonder, Elton John and our own Niall Horan, in fact. It's curated by Lady Gaga and seems to be a kind of live aid in the time of coronavirus. Alan Carr joins me now to tell us more. So who exactly is behind all of this apart from Lady Gaga, Alan?
Well, it's the UN and the World Health Organization, Sean, and they've asked international advocacy organization Global Citizen to support their COVID-19 response by bringing the world together through music. And as you say, the lineup is curated by Lady Gaga and Jimmy Kimmel and Stephen Colbert. And it's billed as an historic cross-platform global special that will celebrate and support healthcare workers and others on the front line. It's a kind of series of virtual no-contact concerts, and it couldn't have come at a better time, I think.
And is it taking Live Aid as its model?
I suppose that's the easiest comparison to make, because if you look at the scale of this thing, it's absolutely massive. There are literally, you know, hundreds of people taking part. And even as a technical challenge, it's up there with Live Aid, which back in 85 was a huge technical challenge as well. Technology is a lot better now. But I think that the most direct comparison you can make between this is with Live Aid in July 1985. Yes, definitely.
However, there won't be a crowd sitting or standing in a large arena, or in Wembley, wasn't it? Was that where we had Live Aid?
Wembley and Philadelphia, have that, yeah.
Yeah, you won't have that kind of immediacy. So how is that going to work? Will all of the artists be working separately at home as well?
Absolutely. It's a no-contact, as I say, no-contact concert. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how it's done. I mean, interestingly, there is no running order for the lineup. And I don't think that's about vanity. I think it's down to the inevitable and possible technical problems that could come up. I'm not trying to put a downer on this, but you can imagine the kind of the technical challenges of undertaking something like this. So the artists in question, and they range into their hundreds, will be performing in self-contained contained areas, and it will be live streamed and later shown on linear television on the BBC and RTE this Sunday. So you can imagine how kind of difficult it's going to be. But then again, considering over the past couple of weeks, you've seen so many artists, including Irish artists, doing online streaming gigs. I think it's kind of it's worthwhile, and it's going to be a very different way of consuming and enjoying music.
Yeah, in fact, just to remind ourselves of the immediacy of Live Aid and that 1985 event, let's listen to a clip from that event. A great interaction here between Freddie Mercury and the crowd. Oh, it's an absolutely superb moment, isn't it? Freddie Mercury literally playing with the audience. Huge crowd in front of him there. I suppose, Alan Carr, in terms of this concert that we're going to get on Sunday night, One World Together at Home, which will be an online event, maybe afterwards we'll get some sense of how people reacted in their own homes, and that might provide us with a seminal moment in 30 or 40 years' time to speak about.
Well, I think you'll probably get it more immediately than that rather than in the aftermath, considering that people have been kind of live streaming themselves, you know, cheering on health services here in the UK, yeah. the NHS and the HSE. So I think that the online activity, real life, which has always been a kind of like a reflection or a sacramentum, kind of some kind of virtual reality, has increasingly become the case over the past couple of months during the pandemic. So I think you will see real time reactions to this, which will be part of the joy. Obviously, we won't have scenes like that incredibly iconic moment with Freddie Mercury there back in '85, and a beautiful moment too. But I think that the interactive kind of factor of this will be as enjoyable as the music for a lot of people.
What about the naysayers? How busy have they been saying that, oh, this is just people being worthy for one thing and also seeking publicity for another?
Oh my God, they've been absolutely out in force. I mean, the cynics, and I count myself among them, Sean, see this as just merely another example of publicity-hungry celebrities looking for attention and virtue signalling on the back of a global crisis. I think that's a load of nonsense. I mean, do you honestly think that Paul McCartney and Lady Gaga need publicity? You know, and as for virtue signalling, I think that the difference with this pandemic, of course, and compared to recent upheavals, is this is something that really does affect everybody. I think closer to home, the Bono bashers are getting bashed, which is good to see. As you know, Bono had the temerity to ask the South Korean government recently to help with PPE purchases, and he said he'd pay for themselves. Only last week, U2 donated 10 million euro to help buy PPE. And as Ian Wilson, the great producer, formerly of RTE, who's known U2 since 1978, pointed out, it's the music business. So people who are having a go at U2 with their tax arrangements in light of this, it just seems a bit churlish. I mean, the likes of Rihanna and George Clooney and Robert De Niro, Leonardo DiCaprio have all stepped up as well. And I think you'd have to be, you know, a genuine churl to actually give out about that kind of thing. I mean, the message seems to be here that we're all in this together. And I think there's no reason why, you know, the likes of you two or De Niro or any of the people taking part in this concert shouldn't be kind of allowed to step up as well.
Absolutely. One World Together at Home is what the title of the concert is. And thanks to Alan Carr for speaking to us about it. It will be on RTE2 on the radio, RTE Player and 2FM, RTE2 Television, that is, and 2FM on the radio and on the player as a simulcast, 7 p.m. on this Sunday evening. Obviously, that is after the event, but that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Dave Gibson was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again. 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.